Before we start this episode, we have a quick message from our sponsors.
If you're studying for the Foreign Service Officer test like us, we have a great study tool for you.
Besides listening to our podcast, we also use FSO Compass.
On FSO Compass, you can find practice tests for every section, comprehensive courses that guide you through the entire application process, and you can even connect with other aspiring U.S. diplomats.
The resources have really helped us prepare, and we hope they help you too. To access FSO Compass and get 10% off your annual subscription, be sure to use the link in our description box.
Good luck!
Hi everybody, welcome back to another episode of How Did We Not Know That? My name's Jack.
And I'm Nat.
And today, Nat is going to talk about a bit of a downer, right? Or is it not that sad?
It's kind of, yeah, it's a heavy topic, but it's, as always, it's super interesting. And I think it's really relevant to what's going on in the U.S. right now, actually. So today I'm going to be talking about Chile, and I will be talking about one of their former presidents, Augusto Pinochet Ugarte, but people just call him Pinochet. And he is a very infamous leader. He's kind of like a lot of countries have leaders who have a lot of influence over a country. So I'm just going to be talking about his military regime and like his effect on Chile. About Pinochet, I think it's important to understand Chile's like situation as a country, its geography, and also it's a little bit of its history. So Chile, if you didn't know, it's the longest and thinnest country in the world, and it's actually almost as long as the U.S. is wide, which is a fun fact.
Okay.
And like its geography is important because it's isolated from pretty much all of its surrounding countries. So in the east, it is separated from Argentina by the Andes Mountains. And then in the north, it's separated from Bolivia and Peru by the world's most barren desert. So it's like very isolated. And like because of this, Chile doesn't have a history of military conflict with other countries. It's like pretty peaceful. They don't have a lot of wars. And Chile is very different compared to its Latin American neighbors because it has a strong tradition of democracy. So a lot of other Latin American countries, unfortunately, had a lot of military dictatorships, right? And so that's a big problem in the region. But Chile was very special. And they were really proud of the fact that they were like a strong, democratic, constitutional government. And so we're going to start in the year 1970 when a man named Salvador Allende, he won a very narrow victory in the 1970 election. So I'm going to be talking about two people pretty much this whole for this episode. So we have Allende and Pinochet. And they're literally like the exact opposites of each other. So Allende comes into office and his party was called the Popular Unity Party. And basically, how do I explain this? So in Chile, there are like a million different political parties. There's like so many. There's like 20 different parties running for president. And so his party was basically a coalition between socialists, communists, radicals, and like other dissident Christian Democrats. And Allende himself like came from an upper middle class family. He's really smart. He is a very good public speaker and he has a very charismatic personality. And he had declared himself as a Marxist since he was a student. And he was one of the founders of Chile's Socialist Party, which was even more extreme than their Communist Party. So he's like very, very, very to the left. And he's elected as president, but again, it's like by a very, very narrow majority. It was a really close call. And he's the first Marxist elected chief of state in the whole entire Western Hemisphere. And obviously, this set off a bunch of alarms in the region because 1970, the U.S. is very anti-communist. They saw what happened in Cuba with Fidel Castro, and they're really scared of other countries recreating that situation. So he's not liked by the U.S. And Allende, as a president, he made a lot of drastic changes in economic policy, which I think you would be interested in, especially in terms of like agrarian reform. And he also nationalized banks and copper mines. And because of this, so that means that like now the government owns it. It's not private enterprise. So now the government owns it, which changes like people's working conditions and salaries. Like it's a really big deal to nationalize utilities like that. And so because of all these like really drastic changes in economic policy, the economy slowed a lot and people's day-to-day lives were disrupted because of this, because he was making a lot of changes, especially in regards to agrarian reform. Like there wasn't as much food as usual. There were a lot more like food shortages and people's like the cost of living increased, poverty went up. And so people were really upset, obviously, with this policy. And they're like, too many changes at once. It's not going well. And so opposition from Chile's Congress and also the middle and upper class grew. And because of this, Allende lost support of the military, which is really important. And okay, also, just before I get into things, like I mentioned earlier, the U.S. had a strong dislike for Allende. They were really scared of a communist government in the Western Hemisphere. Again, Allende was like best friends with Fidel Castro, and like they would visit each other in each other's Allende would go to Cuba, Castro would go to Chile, and they would like take pictures together with them like holding rifles, and they're like, the U.S. is like, yeah, like they weren't happy about this. And also, this is really important, is the fact that Chilean copper mines were U.S. owned. So the U.S. had invested in Chile's economy by purchasing their copper mines. Like, so it's a U.S. investment. And Allende's first measure as president was to nationalize these U.S. copper mines without compensation to the U.S. So he's just like, guess what? I know you. Yeah, he's like, we're taking them back and we're not paying you anything for it. So the U.S. was like, we don't want him as president. So they sent a lot of economic support to the opposition, to Allende's opponents. And so public opposition grew. The U.S. was supporting the opposition. So it's not looking good for Allende. And on September 11th, 1973, the four branches of Chile's armed forces overthrew the government of Allende in a violent coup. And this coup is led by Army Commander-in-Chief Augusto Pinochet Ugarte, which I will talk about him in a second. But yeah, so okay. Allende actually dies in this coup. It's believed that he committed suicide.
Oh, wow. So it was really violent.
Yeah, they like storm his office and like hold him at gunpoint. Yeah, it's very violent. Like they round up a bunch of government officials and just like shoot them on the street.
Oh, yeah, wow.
It's really scary. And so the military junta, which is like just another word for coup, it's like the military government, they take over Chile and they gain absolute control over the country in less than a week, which like if you think about in terms of a coup, like you have to like take over every sector of the government and like have complete control. So less than a week is really, really quick. And it's this, the military was aided by training and financing from the CIA because of the U.S. government's dislike for Allende.
Wow, and that's so kind of sketch.
Yeah, it's very sketchy. And, like, you see a lot of, like, this is not, like, a rare occurrence where, like, the U.S. government likes to send a lot of economic and military support to countries based on, like, which candidate they want to support, who they like, who they don't like. So it's a pretty common occurrence. And yeah, so this coup sadly ends Chile's long tradition of a constitutional government. They had been so proud that they had not had like a military dictatorship, but that comes to an end in 1973. So Pinochet is chosen to lead the country temporarily. When he is chosen, it's like really weird how it happened. So he basically joined the junta at the last minute. He hadn't even dealt with any of the planning. And the reason he was like chosen is because so there's like the army chief of staff is the head of the military, like the most powerful person in the military. And the guy who had that position stepped down like the week before the coup happened because he didn't support the coup. He was like, I can't do this. And so then by default, Pinochet he was like next in line. So now he's the army chief of staff, and like the military junta, they're like, yeah, okay, I guess like I guess you could lead the country for a bit. Because everyone's like initial impression of Pinochet was that he was quiet. He's a harmless guy. He was very friendly and hardworking, and he was known for being very religious and as well as a devoted and tolerant husband and father. Yeah, and so they were like he's very unthreatening, and it was agreed that he would lead for a short period of time, and then the power would transition to another person in the military junta. And at the time, like, if you talk to Chileans in 1973 after this coup, everybody thought that this military junta would last, like, at least less than 2 years. Everybody thought it was a temporary thing. They were like, okay, Allende he was doing a lot of damage to the country. He needed to be removed, but we're not going to have a military dictatorship. Like, we're going to go back to a democratic government.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, so Allende, the people generally didn't like Allende either, or was it split?
A lot of people, by the end, he lost most of his support just because his economic policy, like, I don't know, some people, historians argue that, you know, he made a lot of drastic changes, but maybe over time, the economy would improve. But at first, it went through a huge recession, and people were like, dude, we have no money, we have no food.
Oh, wow.
We know you want, they're like, you want to create this, like, communist government, but it's not working for us. Like, we're not benefiting from this Marxist ideology, so get out of here. And then, yeah, so he's overthrown because he lost support from the military. So everybody thought it would only last 2 years. Do you want to make a guess at how long Pinochet was in power?
So it started in 1973.
Yeah.
Is he, like, still in power today?
No.
Not 50 years later? Okay.
Not 50 years.
Like, 20 years? 25 years?
Oh, it's close. You actually, yeah, it's less than that. He remained in power for almost 17 years, which is still a lot of time. Because also, he was, like, 58, I think, at the time he took over. So, he was, like, fairly old. Yeah. Sorry, not, like, to... He was, like, a bit older, not to insult people, but...
Right, no, your retirement age, you know, by the time
you're like, done, so 17 so. Years, that's a long time for a man that age. Mm-hmm. and so it was a very violent coup, and the violence didn't end after that. Yeah, so Pinochet was, like, this, everyone thought he was, like, this quiet little old man who was, like, this nice, like, Catholic man, and it turned out to be the exact opposite, because the time came when they're like, okay, like, it's time for a new leader. And he was like, actually, I am not stepping down, and I am in charge forever, basically. And so here, this is where we get to the heavy part. So as soon as the coup is successfully finished and the military junta, like, takes power, Pinochet oversees thousands and thousands of raids, executions, and mysterious disappearances, and he authorizes the arrest and torture of just thousands of Chilean citizens. And so his victims included indigenous peoples, labor unions, former government officials, and leftist political parties. So he basically just wanted to get rid of everyone who didn't support him. So more people were killed in, like, the first 4 months following the military coup, from September to December 1973. So they were, more people were killed in these first 4 months than in any other year of the dictatorship. So he just started off strong, like, just creating fear in the whole country. So according to Amnesty International and the UN Human Rights Commission, around 250,000 people were detained for political reasons during this four-month period. 250,000 people were, like, arrested by the government. And, like, there are museums that exist in Chile today that talk about these arrests and tortures because I'm not going to get into details about it because, like, they're extremely graphic. But just, like, people would be arrested and, like, tortured in the most cruel ways, and, like, their family members were involved, and it was just, like... It doesn't matter, like, how powerful they are. It's not just, like, government officials. It's just, like, random... Like, if you're a part of a labor union, you were, like, just brutally, like, tortured and killed. Whoa. There are so many disappearances. So it was really horrifying.
What's the population on Chile? Because 250,000 got arrested, so I'm wondering how big the population is.
In 1973, there's about 10 million people. So, like, 2.5%, which is just a lot. I don't know. Normally, in coups, it's, like, you get rid of, like, former government officials and, like, political leaders. But these people, like, they were eradicating indigenous communities and, like, minority religious groups, like, just everybody. So it was really horrifying. It's a lot of people, and, like, 250,000 people, but during 4 months. Like, you have to remember, that's, like, 2.5% of the population in a 4 month period. So I can't even imagine how horrifying that is. And in 1974, the DINA, I'll refer to them as DINA, they are, like, basically the secret police that are rounding up all these people and torturing them. So the following year, they're officially recognized by the government. They're like, this is our police now. And everyone's like, what? And so, mm-hmm. Actually, what's crazy is that, like, Pinochet was so confident and so cruel and so horrifying that, like, he didn't just focus his attacks on people living in Chile. Like, he also would find people who had, like, fled the country or, like, Chileans living overseas, and he would, like, kill them. And not him personally, but, like, he would send people to kill them. So and even foreign nationals living in Chile, including diplomats, they were among the killed and disappeared. So it's not even like he's not just like, oh, I'm only killing Chileans. No, it doesn't matter where you're from. Like, everybody was a target if you disagreed with him. Outside of the country, the DINA, they spied on Chileans living abroad, and they're actually implicated in the 1976 assassination in Washington, D.C., a former Allende foreign minister, Orlando Letelier. He had opposed the military regime, obviously, because he worked for Allende. He was assassinated in D.C., which is crazy. Like, I don't know. Wow. They reached him all the way in D.C. So flash forward to 1977, only a few years later, and DINA was actually dissolved. Because of this, there was a lessening of repression, and there were no more disappearances. So Pinochet, it's not known that he ever personally shot or tortured anyone, but he was the mastermind of all this, obviously, and he was the one, like, telling people to carry out these actions. So it's just really horrifying how many people agree to follow through with these, like, really cruel psychotic torturings. And yeah. like at its peak, Duna had over 4,000 employees. So that's so many people who are willing to kill and torture people. I don't know. It's really right. scary. Besides the secret police and all these disappearances, Pinochet closed down the National Congress and the Constitutional Tribunal. And he burned all of the voter registration rolls. So it's just really scary. He's like, no more Congress. Like, can you imagine if that happened in the U.S.? Just, hey, no more Congress. And also no more voting. Like, it's really scary.
I would just be, like, on that immigration paper immediately.
Yeah. It's, like, scary. A lot of people. But then all these people fleeing, he still found them overseas.
Oh, my goodness. You're right. Right? You're right. Oh,
it's horrifying. Wow. Even if, like, you're in D.C., you're like, okay, I'm safe. No.
Mm-hmm.
You were killed on American soil. Like, that's wild.
Wow.
And so in terms of, like, how he was, like, besides economic policy, let's talk about that. So he stopped the distribution of lands because, like, Allende was like, okay, everybody gets equal amounts of lands, you know, like, Marxist ideology. So he stopped that. He was like, no, like, we're not doing that. And he cut government expenditures and, like, welfare programs. He's like, no more. And then he eliminated price controls, which, like, Allende had put into place price controls. And then he promoted free trade. But actually, the economy flourished under Pinochet's regime. Like, at first, like, it was suffering so much under Allende, and then all of a sudden you see, like, this huge economic boom. Wow. And, like, I am not an economist, but a lot of people, like, some people argue that, like, I don't know, a lot of Western governments, including especially the U.S., really disliked Allende's government, and so, but they supported Pinochet, and they were like, hey, okay, now we're gonna invest in Chile and provide financial support. Yeah.
So they thought, so economically, it did well under the Pinochet regime?
Like, really well at first. Like, people's living standards improved significantly at the beginning, and they were like, wow, like, my day-to-day life is so much better. Like, all these torturings and killings and disappearances are still happening, but people are like, hey, at least I can afford to, like, buy food for my family, and yeah. like, I'm living more comfortably than I was before. So that's where, like, so it becomes tricky. Yeah, and, like, I'll get into that later. So, like I said, the U.S. actually did support Pinochet at first. They supported him for more than half of the duration of his dictatorship, solely because of his strong anti-communist stance. And so the U.S. was just so, like, hyper-focused on, are you communist or anti-communist? But yeah, and so the U.S. extended military and economic aid to Chile. They publicly denied his human rights abuses, even when the victims were U.S. citizens, like, they were like, not happening.
Wow.
And it wasn't just, like, one president or, like, one political party, like, U.S. political party that favored him. The support for Pinochet continued through the presidencies of Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, and Ronald Reagan at first. So, but in the mid-1980s, the U.S. turned against Pinochet for two reasons. So first, there was just so much evidence of, like, human rights abuses that they couldn't just, like, deny it anymore. They're like, okay, yeah, like, we have to acknowledge this. And also, between the years 1982 to 1984, Chile was suffering from an economic downturn. And so the Chilean public had also turned against Pinochet. They were like, what the heck? We were doing so good, and now we're heading into recession again. Like, what are you doing? So, like, Pinochet actually became a liability for American political interests. So they were like, okay, I guess now we don't support you. And so, yeah, Pinochet, it was not, like, people were really upset with him. They were like, save the economy. You ruined it. You did so good, and then you ruined it.
Wow. And meanwhile, the economy is now collapsing, or what?
Yeah, in, like, between this two-year period, there's just an economic downturn. They're not in, like, a full recession, but it's, like, slowing down.
Did he?
Because they had this huge boom, and then it's, like, slowing down, and people are like, no, no, no. We want to keep flourishing. In 1980, so before this, like, slight economic downturn, Pinochet had actually drafted a new constitution, which said he could remain in office until 1989, or possibly 1997, which is crazy. Like, he came into office 1973, but basically he's like, I'm staying here for a long, long time. And but then they fall into a mild recession, and there are a lot of protests on the streets, and support decreases. And so in 1988, this is, like, people are like, what? Historians are still kind of confused why Pinochet decided to go through with this, but basically his government held a plebiscite, or which is basically a referendum. So a referendum is, like, when the people of a country, of a nation, vote to make an amendment in the Constitution, or, like, vote to pass a new law. So they have this referendum to see if he should rule for another 8 years. And Pinochet was, like, really confident that he was going to win. He's like, yeah, the people love me because of my economic policy. Because at this point, like, the economy was, like, doing pretty okay. Like, they had fallen out of their recession, and they're like, okay, like, it's fine, I guess. So, but this referendum backfired on him because the proposition was defeated. So people voted no. They're like, no, we don't want you to stay in office for another 8 years. But the scary thing, the really scary thing, is that it was a really close call. 58% said no, but that means 42% of Chileans said, yes, we are aware of all these, like, torturings and killings, but, like, the economy is doing good, so yes, we want you as president. So basically Pinochet is, like, voted out of office, but he negotiated a deal where he would still be able to remain as head of the armed forces until at least 1998. And then after he would step down as head of armed forces, he would become senator for life. So he would still have a lot of influence on Chilean politics. And, like, it's just really interesting because later he would sit down in the body he had closed down 25 years before among leaders he had persecuted and exiled. So it's, like, very weird. It's like, you closed down the Congress earlier, but now you're, yeah, like, a, like, Congress member.
Everyone. Yeah. Wow. Oh, man.
So in the 1990 election, Patricio Aylwin, who is a member of the Christian Democrat Party, he's elected president. And so Chile has returned to democracy, which is really exciting. But it's, like, 1990, like, that's recent.
Yeah.
And again, Pinochet remained as head of the military. Yikes. But one of Aylwin's first acts was the creation of the National Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So they basically investigated all those torturings and killings and disappearances under the Pinochet regime. And so they had confirmed more than 35,000 cases of torture. And they concluded that 3,197 people died or disappeared between September 1973 and March 1990 at the hands of state agents. So, again, like, 250,000 people were arrested during those first 4 months, but not all of them were tortured, like, thankfully. And, yeah, so the government did kill over 3,000 people, which is really horrifying.
What?
Okay. Yeah, and so fast forward to October 1998. 83-year-old Pinochet traveled to England for back surgery. And as soon as he arrived in England, surprise, he was arrested on a warrant issued by Spain for the investigation of the deaths of Spanish nationals at the hands of Chilean security forces. So this is crazy. It's like, well, because international law is, like, really tricky. So people are like, oh, can they do this? Is it legal? And obviously, the Chilean government immediately asked for him to be released, and they argued that foreign courts had no jurisdiction over actions taken on Chilean soil. But Spain countered that argument by saying that Pinochet's actions constituted crimes against humanity, therefore they did have the right. And so this debate continues for 15 months. He's like under house arrest in England. And then in January 2000, Pinochet is allowed to return home to Chile after a British court rules that he's physically unfit to stand trial because he's super duper old. He's like wheelchair bound. He's not in good physical health. But he goes home and he continues to face investigation by Chilean authorities. And Chilean authorities actually discovered that Pinochet had stashed about $30 million in 125 secret U.S. bank accounts. And so people got super upset about this, which it's kind of ridiculous, but like people, so obviously like Pinochet is like very right wing, like he's right, very far right on the political spectrum. And so other rightists had been prepared to like tolerate all these torturings and killings and disappearances, but this crosses the line because like they were so upset because they thought Pinochet was different than the other dictators in Latin America. They thought he was a lot better. They thought he was very honest. Like even though he was controlling this military regime, like he wasn't corrupt. He was still like a very honest guy. But then it turns out that he was stealing money from Chile and hiding it. And so people are like, oh, so you were this corrupt dude after all. And they're like, we don't like you. So later that year, he's stripped of his immunity because like he couldn't be prosecuted because he was a former president. But then they were like, no, you have no more immunity. And he was ordered to stand trial on charges of human rights abuses. So they're like, we don't care how old you are, you're going to jail. And so he's placed under house arrest with his wife and his four children who are also arrested. They're like, we're all going to take you to court. But it's like back and forth, back and forth. But then in 2002, Chile's Supreme Court ruled that he was mentally incapable of defending himself in court. So they're like, oh, crap, now we can't take you to court. And then he, soon afterward, Pinochet resigns from his post as senator for life. But then, last time, one more switch. In 2005, the Supreme Court said, okay, actually, yes, he is fit to stand trial. But Pinochet dies the following year, on December 10th, 2006, at the age of 91. He died of a heart attack. And so he died without ever being tried in court for the human rights abuses that occurred while he was in power, which is really frustrating.
And he lived a long life. Isn't that the worst? Good die young. Like
91.
Worst live forever and nothing bad happens to them.
And like, yeah, he never went to jail. Like he was under house arrest in England, but it's not like he was in jail and then he got to go home and he was still senator for life. He had all this power. I'm sure he had $30 million stashed in the U.S. Yeah. And well, some good news though, is that eventually hundreds of Chilean torturers and killers were indicted. Dozens of them were sent to prison, which like, I don't know. I read that and I was like, dozens, that's it. Like obviously like there are a lot more, but you take what you can get.
Yeah.
Especially after like a long period of time, becomes a lot harder to prosecute people. So just to wrap up, like just to conclude, you had mentioned, like it's a really tricky situation, like and Chileans today are still wrestling with this like moral dilemma, like how do we reflect on Pinochet, because there are a lot of positive and negative effects of his regime, and it's basically like, I don't know, it's economic benefits versus human rights abuses. So like you could just say like, well, why don't we just say that, okay, yes, they were good, the government did good things, but then also like horrible things. But it's not like the Chilean people are completely innocent, because they did have they did have the chance to vote. Like, do we want him in power again for another eight years? So in this 1989 referendum, all Chileans were given the chance to say like yes or no, should he be in power, and the majority of them said no, but still 42% of Chileans said yes, I think he should be in power. So I don't know, despite these evil abuses, like people still have to like deal with that, that it was still a close call. And the reason I chose this topic is because I'm reading my book, Upheaval, and it's written by Jared Diamond. It's about nations in crisis. And so one of the chapters is about Chile. So basically, I'm just talking about every chapter that I read because it's so interesting. But Jared Diamond, basically, his conclusion is that there are two types of Chileans. So when you talk to Chileans about Pinochet, they're either going to say, oh, you know, like Pinochet's economics benefited Chile economically, but his torturings and killings were inexcusable. Or they're going to say, oh, Pinochet's torturings and killings were evil, but you have to understand that his policies benefited Chile economically. So, like, it's very interesting to see, like, which one, like, comes first. Which one is the but? Like, are you, like, are you more concerned about economic, like, economic strength or human rights? Like,
Is this your question that you wanted to ask me?
Kind of. Well, yeah, I mean, you can reflect on this, but I do have one more thing. But yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I just want to say that's so funny that you bring that up, because in my book that I'm reading, Arguing with Zombies by Paul Krugman, who's one of my favorite economists. I didn't want to tell people he's my favorite, but he is my favorite. But he has this really great line towards, I guess, like the end. And it was just like, it's a fallacy to think that human rights and caring about people and economic growth are incompatible, because they're not. You can't have both. They're not different things. And I think that I really resonate with that. And I obviously like Nat and I's favorite president. Well, my favorite president is Abraham Lincoln. And I really like Jimmy Carter as well. So I'm much more of a, like, human rights always should come first. And I believe in, like, strong economic policy that also takes into account the well-being of the general public. So that's, I'm very much, no, Pinochet is horrible. I don't care what. Also, like, economies go up and down, right? And it's also another fallacy, if you study more economics, that the leader of a country has a huge effect on the economy. Obviously, setting, land sharing policies or something like that, and then price settings and producing more money, taking more money, higher taxes, lower taxes, that can drive it, and that's important as well. But there's cycles in economies, so obviously even though there was a boom, there's also going to be stagflation at some point for the country. And so is it worth that 4-month boom to have all of those people killed and tortured? No, I don't think that's worth it. So that's my take.
Yeah. What about you? I also agree. Like, I mean, but like, it's hard because I don't know. I wonder, like, if I was living in Chile at the time and I was like extremely impoverished and like I can barely afford to buy food, and then all of a sudden, I don't know, my living standards increase significantly and like I'm able to afford things. Like, I don't know. I do kind of understand. Like, I think it depends on your situation. Like, if you were, like, extremely impoverished and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I, like, can afford to, like, live a comfortable life, I could see why. I don't know. Like, I could understand their support for his economic policy. But, I mean, I don't know.
I can at first, though, because for Allende, like, obviously his economic policy isn't working. You can vote him out. But when that re-election came, the referendum, I still can't, like, the economy's in stagflation at that point, from what you're telling me, it seems like. So why would you vote for him again? Why wouldn't you want to return to the...
And I'm also, like, I don't know if I... Like, Chile had a strong democratic history, so I would be really afraid if, like, all of a sudden this guy comes in, he's like, no, I'm serving forever. Like, I would be like, okay, maybe you're doing a good job, but, like, we need to stay, like, within the term limit, like, presidential term limit. I would get really nervous. Like, it's not good. It's never a good idea if, like, one person, like, rules for too long. So I don't know. I think it's hard. Like, in hindsight, obviously, it's like, okay, looking back, I'm like, there, you can't, like, his human rights abuses are inexcusable, and, like, just, like, the brutality of the tortures is, like, so disturbing that there's no excuse for it. But I can imagine, like, I don't know what it was like at the time. I also am, like, did people, like, obviously people are aware that there are, like, all these disappearances, but do they know, like, the exact number? Like, do they know how severe it is? I don't know what the people are aware of, at the time of that referendum. But, yeah, but Chileans today, when you're reflecting, I think it is, I'm not Chilean. This is just, like, an outsider perspective. It's really, like, economic policy and economic well-being is important, but, like, it's hard, like, man, making excuses, like, so being today, like, oh, it's good.
Today, do Chileans still support Pinochet? They still think that he was a good leader?
Well, that's the thing, is, like, it's kind of, like, half and half, and people are, like, they all kind of agree, like, okay, obviously he wasn't perfect, but it's, like, how much do you value the economic turn, because like Chile was a like pretty like impoverished country, and now it's like not so, and it's a so I don't know, there's a lot of economic improvements that came from the regime. So the real reason like I chose this topic is because I started reading this chapter about Chile, and like the opening paragraph that like Jared Diamond, he like he starts off this like story of Pinochet's regime by saying like, okay, Chile had like one of the strongest democratic traditions in all of Latin America, and all Chileans would have thought that like a military coup and like having a military junta take over, like they would have thought that would have been impossible. They never thought that possibility would exist, but it happened. And so this book was published in 2019. And Jared Diamond says, like, okay, recently there have been a lot of questions about America's democratic tradition and whether or not it's possible for this democratic tradition to come to an end. And so I started reading this chapter, like, a few days after the January 6th violent insurrection on the U.S. Capitol. And so I'm, like, reading this, and it's all about, he's talking about, like, you know, like, can this happen in the U.S.? Like, can we see such a drastic change, and, like, the end of democracy in the U.S. So I just wanted to, like, talk about this really quick. And I'm going to be talking about Jared Diamond's arguments, because I think he poses a lot of, like, very insightful, and, like, I think he says a lot of things that people should think about, no matter what country you're from. But, obviously, the U.S. is very different than Chile. They're not the same, but some of these differences either increase or decrease the risk of an end to democracy in the U.S. So some factors that decrease the chance of, like, of the end of democracy is basically the U.S. does have a stronger history of democratic traditions. And most importantly, there's a complete absence of independent political actions by our military throughout history. We don't, like, our military, it's hard to imagine, like, the military disagreeing, like overthrowing a president, you know, in the U.S. But some factors that increase the risk of an end of tradition, end of democracy in the U.S. is the high amount of private gun ownership. There's a very high amount of private gun ownership in the U.S. And there's also more history of violence against groups such as Native Americans, African Americans, and some immigrant groups. So we do have a history of violence, like our government has a history of violence against certain groups. But so Jared Diamond argues that if democracy does end in the U.S., it won't be through an uprising led by armed forces. So he doesn't think there's going to be a military coup. He argues that instead it'll happen through political polarization. And basically he says that there's been, like, the deterioration of political compromise is accelerating. So, like, political compromise is not a thing anymore. Or, like, it's not going to be a thing. And so, I mean, I think it's, if you just watch the news, it's very apparent that it's become very polarized, very, like, black and white, like one side versus the other. You don't see a lot of compromise between either parties. And then he also says that the decline of social capital, which is basically connections among individuals, like that's going to have a huge effect. He says that, like, we don't really see, Americans don't really meet up in, like, face-to-face groups anymore to talk about politics. Like, we don't really have, like, town hall meetings. Well, especially now because of COVID. Like, this is pre-COVID. But, like, we don't really have town hall meetings. Like, people don't show up to town hall meetings. There aren't, like, a lot of, like, face-to-face political organization meetings. There's less involvement in, like, professional societies. Most people choose to interact online in regards to political beliefs and ideologies. And, like, he says that that leads to a mistrust. Like, it's harder for people to trust people in real life. Like, they read things online and then they don't trust. Like, when people talk to you face-to-face, they have a lot of mistrust. I don't know if you agree with that, but basically, he says that how the end of democracy will happen in the U.S. is that, like, one political party will manipulate voter registration. They're going to fill the courts with sympathetic judges. They're going to use those courts to challenge election outcomes. Oh, and then they're going to use law enforcement and the police, National Guard, Army Reserve, or the Army itself to suppress political opposition. So, I don't know. This is, like, a very heavy political topic. But I just think it's really interesting to see what happened to Chile and how drastically things changed in such a short time period. And then now, especially with current events, it's hard not to think, like, is it possible in the U.S.? So, yeah. Wow. I just want to open that up to you. What are your thoughts? It's a really, like, heavy thing. But do you have any thoughts?
That's crazy. Well, now I'm, like, really anxious. oh, my gosh. Well, that's... thanks for bringing that up. I recently started reading the book as well, per your recommendation, so I was going to hit that chapter eventually. Hey. But,
sorry. Yeah, sorry if it's a spoiler alert.
No, it's fine. It's good. That is really interesting. So, like, I would not be surprised. I've never thought that, like, governments stay the way they are. I'm very grateful to be an American, but I know that, like, the being an American and being in this country right now is good, but anything can change. Like, the economy is never a stable thing. You know, you have to actively work to maintain an economy. So, you know, having the biggest GDP now might not be the same in 20 years. Also having just like all of my rights. It's the, like, that's not something I take for granted. I know that that's, that can change, as you see with many other countries. And then there was a violent uprising at the Capitol Hill to overturn the results of a fair election. And so nothing surprises me anymore. I wouldn't be surprised if something happened. But now with the rise of fake news and being in the tech space as I am, I know how bad that is. I don't even use social media anymore because I'm so sick and tired of seeing things that aren't fact-checked. And I just don't get my news from Facebook. That's the worst place to get your news. I try to make sure that I'm reading, like, proper literature from, like, real professionals in that field. And I don't know. I am both optimistic that it can get better, but also would not be surprised if things change. Like, I'm not, I don't think that, that we could always be like this.
I mean, think of how much our country has changed, like, now, like, I don't know, 1960s America versus today. I don't know, things change, and I think this is definitely one of those points in history where they're, like, I don't know, people are going to look back at this period and be like, wow, what would it like to, like, what would it have been like to live during this period? It's really, it makes me really anxious. Just because, like, every day it's like, oh, this couldn't happen, and then, like, I think, like, oh, nothing can shock me anymore, and then, I don't know. It's a lot of shocking.
Well, when you when you said that in the coup d'etat, they literally shot and killed and held people at gunpoint. Like, people at the Capitol were armed, and they were looking for Congress members.
They were looking for Congress members. They were looking for the vice president. Like,
yeah, they were talking about literally killing the vice president, and it's crazy to me that people think that it's not a big deal, because I still hear people kind of, oh, it wasn't a coup. It wasn't that big of a deal.
Yeah. Like, America's, like, democratic traditions are definitely being tested now, and it's either going to fall apart completely or it's going to come out stronger than ever. I don't know.
Right. I think that the tech world has to get it together with the...
We really need
to... And the thing is, it's not that easy. Like, just knowing how algorithms work, it's not that easy to reel that stuff in. I did an episode called The Internet Flame Wars, where I talked about how when the internet was just starting, it was really hard to track down hate speech. It's even harder today. And so when the responsibility falls... If the responsibility falls on an individual, it usually is not going to work out, because... If you make it up to, it's the same with, like, using less plastic. If you make that the job of an individual, they're probably not going to use less plastic. Like, there needs to be limitations put on certain, I don't know, certain aspects. And if I'm off of social media, not everyone's going to get off social media and then start reading, like, proper news sources. Like, the arguments I hear are ridiculous to me, like, especially about economic, and it's so frustrating, because if you actually study that stuff, it's so annoying the way people think about how economies work and how the government works, how technology works.
Another thing, like, I don't know, there's just so many things wrong, but also just, like, people's attention span has decreased so much. I'm very much at fault. Like, it takes a lot for me to read a full article. Like, I'm trying to get better at that, where, like, reading an article from start to finish. But, like, most people, I don't know, especially if you're getting your news from Facebook, you're just looking at the headlines. Like, how many times do you, like, click on an article, actually? Like, most people just read the headline, and then they just talk about it. Like, that's their whole perception is, like, based on that headline. Like, Facebook, Snapchat has a huge news function. Oh, my gosh. And it's just all clickbait titles. So, like, people read these, like, super, like, dramatized titles that are, like, just over-exaggerated. And then they're like, oh, this is, like, the truth. And it's like, oh, man, I don't know. There's just a lot of issues. And it's really hard. Like, how do you face it? How do you fix it? Like, censorship is, like, a really big deal here, obviously. Like, free speech is a very strong value to Americans.
And it should be. I think free speech is, like, the core component of what makes America so great. But the issue is, like, why is there no repercussion for, like, there is repercussion for slander and libel, right? Saying things that are not true about people and causing harm in that way. So,
but then I mean, that, like, because then, like, this false fake news, like, I actually hate saying the word, like, fake news, because I feel like there's such, like, a stigma, like, I don't know, there's such a whatever, but anyway, like, but all this, like, false, like, this misinformation that's on the internet is leading to violent insurrections. Like, people are believing that the election, like, people don't believe the election results are valid. Like, they think that the election was tampered with, and, like, where are they finding this information? They're finding it on the internet. Like, they're and it's like, okay, and that's leading them to, like, storm the U.S. Capitol. And it's like, okay, obviously, like, we can't just,
and the thing, like, is, they don't care.
There can't be no consequences.
People don't care either. People don't care about the truth, even if you try to come to someone with reason. Like, it doesn't, does not matter. They do not
care. People don't want their minds to be changed.
I think that's what I'm learning from our podcast, is that countries are so fragile. Like, conflict is not, you look at countries with conflict and you think, oh, like, we'll never be like that. That's so barbaric almost, but that's.
Yeah, like, oh, we're better than that.
Right, we're more civilized, but we're not. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, we'll see.
And on that note, okay.
On that note.
Thank you so much, Nat, for doing this episode. What a page-turner, food-for-thought episode. Great job on it. And, thank you for listening, everyone. Hope you message us with your thoughts. We would love to hear what you guys think.
Especially if any listeners are from Chile or have a Chilean background. I'm so curious to hear your perspective
on this. Tweet us at HDWNKT or email us at howdidwenotknowthat@gmail.com.
Yay. Thank you for listening.
Bye. Bye.
This has been an episode of How Did We Not Know That? If you liked it, don't forget to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.
You can also follow us on all social media, including YouTube, at How Did We Not Know That?
If you thought our podcast was low quality, we know. We thought so too. Help us improve the podcast by contributing to our Patreon.
Thank you for listening, and see you guys next week.